God, grateful for this beautiful fall day. Grateful for this opportunity to just gather together with friends and brothers and sisters to talk about the things that matter most. To open us up, we're going to look at something that is very familiar, probably to many of us. But familiarity often breeds unfamiliarity, and we may be so used to these words that we don't think about their significance or their weight or their claim on us or their challenge to us. So help us to be open to hearing these, we're going to look at these 10 commandments. Help us to hear them afresh and anew, in new and challenging ways that inspire us to go live in new and challenging ways as well. We love you. We're grateful for all your gifts to us. Thanks. We give thanks in the name of the one in whom we live and move and have our being. And everybody said, amen. So we began with creation. God made a good world. It, human desire and the desire to be God and play God sent that good world into crisis, which then led God to call a person, a family, beginning with a man named Abraham. God essentially invited his family to be a part of the rescue and renewal of the world. He says to Abraham, the world's going to be blessed through you and your family. And then Abraham's family end up in captivity in Egypt. And if you were with us last week, we looked at the Exodus story and how God, through a man named Moses, how God challenged the Pharaoh of the day and essentially led the people out of slavery. We actually talked about when the Bible talks about salvation, primarily it's referencing this story. And salvation means liberation, freedom, and it takes its meaning from the Exodus story. And we left last week with just this idea of what is it? Because what gives the Exodus story power isn't just that it happened, but it's that it still happens. And we talked about what is it that we need to be set free of? And often it's not even, for us, it's not even physical freedom necessarily. But what is it we need to be set free of? What attitudes, what behaviors, what ways of thinking and living and feeling and acting in the world do we need to be liberated from so that we can be fully alive like God has intended us and made us to be? God rescues the Hebrews so that they can be fully alive. And then the Hebrews go through this amazing moment where they're faced with this big body of water in front of them. Depends on how you translate it. Some people translate it Red Sea. Some people think it was a different one called the Sea of Reeds. It could be read either way. Either way, they're faced with this body of water, and you know, God, through Moses, Charlton Heston, parts the body of water, and the people walk through on dry ground. And that's when the journey begins. We often talk about salvation in our context as if I got saved, past tense, and that's the end of it. And in the Bible, salvation is always progressive. It always, so salvation isn't the end of the journey. Salvation may be the end of the journey, but the liberation was the beginning. And when they walk through the water, their story is far from over. They actually wander, and we'll look at a little of this maybe next week, but they actually wander in the wilderness looking for the land of Canaan, and they wander for 40 years. 40 years. Can you imagine? And don't you know somebody's going, would you just stop and ask for directions? 40 years. They experience all sorts of amazing things. They have real issues with, they doubt God's word. They doubt God's ability sometimes. They live with this fear that God's not going to come through for them. And at the exact same time, in those 40 years, they experience provision and care from God in ways that they never would have imagined. They were hungry, so God gave them this substance called manna. In Hebrew, manna means what is it? So I think that's like a little joke we're supposed to get, but since we're not ancient Hebrews, it kind of falls flat. But it was this flaky white, it was like dandruff from the sky, and they would go out every morning and collect their ration of dandruff for the day, and they would go in and eat it, and God provided for them. Then they got a little upset because, you know, in Egypt we ate meat a lot, and so far we're just getting divine dandruff. We would really like something else. And so God says, okay, here's the thing. You want to eat meat? And this is one of my favorite like interaction because it's so parental. Like you can imagine a parent saying this. God says to the people, you want to eat meat? Then you're going to eat meat till it comes out of your nostrils. Like, can't you imagine? Isn't that just a parent thing to say to their kids? Like, oh, you're going to eat it till it comes out of their nostrils. God provides for them in so many ways. He gives them water from a rock. He gives them a cloud to guide them by day and a pillar of fire to guide them at night. God is just continually guiding these folks. But I want to focus on something that happens before the real wilderness wandering begins. I want to focus on an event that happens about 3 months into their journey, which ended up being a long, long journey. And I want to examine what's going on here. And we're going to look today at the Ten Commandments. So if you've ever heard of the Ten Commandments, we're going to look at Exodus 19 and 20. I'm sure you've heard of the Ten Commandments, people fighting over where they should be and shouldn't be and all those kind of useless arguments. But today we're going to talk about what does it mean if we take these seriously? What would it look like for us to really take these commandments seriously? And what kind of claim are they making on us as people? And as people in this tradition, I mean, we're Christians in the Abraham tradition. There are three big world faiths that come from Abraham, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And so as a branch of that, this story has an impact on us. And I think we ignore it to our own peril. So we'll take a look at it. On the third month, on exactly the third month anniversary of the Israelites leaving the land of Egypt, they came into the Sinai Desert. They traveled from Rephidim, came to the Sinai Desert, and set up camp there. Israel camped there in front of the mountain while Moses went up to God. This is the mountain. Now, sometimes in the Old Testament, it calls it Horeb, and sometimes it calls it Sinai. There's a real easy explanation for that. They put two sources together. One writer had called it Horeb. The other had called it Sinai. When they put them together, they just kind of left the different names there. But it's the same place. This is the mountain that God said to Moses through the burning bush experience, when I rescue the people, you're going to come back here and you're going to worship me here, and we're going to talk about what it looks like for you guys to be my people here. So that's kind of what's happened. Moses has in some ways come full circle. This is the place where he first encountered God. And now they're back and they're free. And God has something to say to Moses. The Lord called to him from the mountain. This is what you should say to Jacob's household and declare to the Israelites. You saw what I did to the Egyptians, how I lifted you up on eagle's wings and brought you to me. So now, if you faithfully obey me and stay true to my covenant, you'll be my most precious possession out of all the peoples, since the whole earth belongs to me. You'll be a kingdom of priests for me and a holy nation. These are the words you should say to the Israelites. So he gives Moses a message. Go tell the people this. Saw what happened in Egypt. I liberated you. I'm your God. If you walk in faithfulness with me, you're going to be my people. Moses came down, called together the people's elders, and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. The people all responded with one voice. Everything that the Lord has said, we will do. Moses reported to the Lord what the people said. Do you see how funny that last statement is? Moses reported to who? The Lord. Does God not know what the people said? It's almost like Moses becomes, in middle school, when you want to ask a girl out and you have your buddy do it for you? That's what this looks like. God's like, I'm not really sure how they feel. Could you go ask them if they'll date me? And God sends Moses down. Moses talks to the people. The people say yes. Moses goes back up like, they said yes. They said yes. I think that's just a little comical. But you see, Moses has kind of become this intermediary. He's functioning as this go-between between the God and the people. God wants to be in a relationship with you. Well, do you want to be in a relationship with God? And the people say, yeah, everything God said so far, we're totally cool with. Say yes to God on our behalf. Then Exodus 20. Moses has relayed God's message to the people, the people's message to God. And that was funnier than you guys realized. But I'll just pretend you're still in like a sleep issue thing. Then Exodus 20. Then God spoke all these words. The word commands is never in this, we call the Ten Commandments. The word command doesn't show up. It actually in Hebrew says the 10 words. God spoke 10 words to the people. In the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, there are 613 commands. The 10 we're going to look at, and then, a whole bunch of others that deal with a whole bunch of other issues, like what kind of clothes you should wear and how you should trim your beard. And how many of you are going through No Shave November right now? Anybody doing No Shave November? That's like every month for you, though, Adam. I don't know that we count that. How are you allowed biblically to trim your facial hair? What are you allowed to do? That whole sort of thing, how to cook your food, what you can and can't eat. But these 10 have really been significant. And it's not just in the Christian era. These 10 were very significant in Judaism. And what you may find interesting is if you go pick up a Hebrew translated Bible, if you go pick up a Catholic Bible, and if you pick up a more Protestant translation, they will all have different orders for the ten, different numbers for the Ten Commandments. They number them differently. So depending on who you're talking to, if you're talking to a Jewish person, they're going to think the Ten Commandments are actually, here's the Ten Commandments. And if you talk to a Catholic person, they may say, well, actually, here's the Ten Commandments. And then you talk to a Protestant and you'll have, no, here are the Ten Commandments. They just, where they decide to number, it's just interesting to me. God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now, in the ancient Near East, they had these contracts, these treaties that they would often draw up between a very powerful party and the party who was kind of the beneficiary of their power. And the Ten Commandments follows this ancient treaty form. So it's almost like God is making a treaty, a kind of a peace agreement with the people. If it usually begins with, here's what I've done for you, brought you out of Egypt. Now, if you want to live in a relationship with me, here's what you do. You live by these sort of guidelines. So I brought you out of the house of slavery. You must have no other gods before me. It's interesting. God doesn't even debate whether or not other gods exist. They came out of Egypt, a place with many gods, and God simply says to the people, if you want to be in this kind of relationship with me, then all other gods are off limits. You don't worship anything else. I am first priority. I'm number one. Nobody else is in competition with me. Michael Duggan says, this first commandment is the foundational precept. The nine that follow elaborate on the practical ways of practicing loyalty to Yahweh. Here's what he's saying. The first commandment is really the big one. And then all the other commandments flow out of this is what it looks like to put God first. If you honor God above everything else, here's the kind of life that you're going to end up living. You're going to end up doing the following things. It continues. God continues. Do not make an idol for yourself. No form whatsoever of anything in the sky above or on the earth below or in the waters under the earth. Do not bow down to them or worship them because I, the Lord your God, am a passionate, some translations say jealous, God. Don't make idols. What were idols? What are idols? Idols are these little carvings, engravings, statues, metalworks that essentially represent a god. They stand in place of a god. So people would often make them in the ancient world as a way of making their god present to them. And they would often worship. I don't think people really believe that these were the gods, but that these somehow represented the gods. This God says, do not even try to capture me because you will fail. Right? So if you make while this is going on, the people are actually making an idol. They're making a golden calf. And while they're making the calf, so let's say you choose to make a statue of God and you choose to make it like a big bull. I mean, that would do a good job at saying that God is strong, but what about God's compassion? So you'd make another statue that tries to represent God's compassion, and then you try to make another statue that represents God's wisdom, and eventually all you have are like all these statues. God says, don't get into that. Because in some ways, making an idol is trying to control the deity. If I make an idol, then I can control when this God is present and when this God is not. I can control what this God does. I can somehow manipulate this God. And God says, no, you can't. First of all, this God's always present. You don't need an idol to prove that this God is present. Second of all, when God made human beings, he made them in his what? Image. Image. This God doesn't need idols because he has people. And something about what it means to be human represents God. So I'm supposed to, at my very best, and again, that very best is a small window, but at my very best, something about me should tell you something about God. And at your very best, something about you should tell me of something about God, because as God's image bearers, we represent God to all of creation. So God doesn't need idols because he has us. He has us to reflect his goodness and glory and wisdom to the world. And I think we read this passage and we think, man, this is pretty primitive, pretty barbaric. We don't make idols anymore, do we? We don't actually go carve a statue and say, this is the God I worship. No, we're too sophisticated for that. But you know what I do believe? I do believe we still have an idol problem in our lives and in our world. I think we have a big idol problem. But I think for us, we don't carve statues. We buy houses or we buy new cars or we have people. I think sometimes even when it comes to religious things, we end up making them idols. I remember when I was a kid, I was in high school. I was just starting to learn to preach bad sermons, you know, and at that time there was a big flap going on in the church, the denomination I grew up in. I grew up Baptist. There was this big flap going on about worship in church and what that should be like. And there were these kind of people who at the time we would have said represented the old guard, who said drums and all that stuff are bad. We just need to keep it with the piano and organ, right? Those are the instruments of worship. And I was, you know, 15, 16 years old, and I thought they were totally misguided, and if it didn't have a drum beat, it wasn't worship, right? And I can remember being in these heated arguments with people about how small-minded they were and how, you know, you're not getting it. And what I've learned now is if whether you were kind of on the side that said piano and organ only or whether you're on the side that said, yeah, it needs to have a good beat to it, that became an idol for everybody involved. I mean, when you ultimately end up saying, I can't worship God unless these following criteria are met. The problem is not with God, and the problem is not with how worship's going. The problem is with my heart and your heart. Because we have placed something above the actual experience of being with brothers and sisters and encountering God together and learning from God together. So I think sometimes the way we even do church can become an idol. The first real, like, out-of-my-hometown pastor thing I did lasted for a year, and I was lucky. And during the year process, it was this really, really small church. Everybody in the church was related. And there were two deacons. And I remember, you know, you can tell I'm not big on those big pulpit things. Like, my grandpa had one that was built for him. He was a big guy, real tall, real big. And, I mean, it was like this thing. And every time I get behind one of those, I feel the need to drive it. You know, I'm just not used to them. And so I said, you know, I really don't, I'm not comfortable with those. Can we move it so I can just have some room? And the deacon said, oh, that's great. Sounds like a great idea. The next Sunday morning, I come in and hear this low, muffled weeping in the room. People are crying, really crying. You know, you'll hear something like, oh, you know, I'm like, oh, did something happen I wasn't aware of? And finally, somebody says to me, yeah, the founding pastor's grandfather made that on his deathbed. I said, well, that's a bit of information you should have given me before I completely took it off and out. But even these images become sort of things for us that we attach to more than we attach to God in some way. I think we do this in a really big way with theology. I think we worship our doctrines and our beliefs more than we worship the God we're trying to talk about. When you're in a conversation with somebody and they immediately start throwing out words like heresy, then you realize that they're really intent on protecting an idea, and they're not so concerned about the God we're actually talking about, right? So I think orthodoxy, even though right beliefs matter, and again, I've said this 100 times, do I have all the right beliefs? There's a number of you in this room who would love to scream no right now, right? And I'll fully admit I don't have all the right beliefs. I don't think you do either. I think we're all doing the best we can. I think when we worship at that altar, the altar of right belief, we're ultimately worshiping something that will leave us very disappointed. And in the end, we'll find out we were worshiping at a false idea of God and not God. God, you know. So anyway, notice what happens next, though. This is the same command. Don't make an idol. Notice what God says to Moses next. I punish children for their parents' sins, even to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. But I am loyal and gracious to the 1,000th generation of those who love me and keep my commands. Can we just be real honest? How many of you have a... Let me just translate what this is saying, and then you can tell me. God is saying, I hold kids accountable to the third and fourth generation for what their parents have done. But I'm really nice to people to the 1,000th generation of people who've loved me. How many of you have a problem saying, God will punish my kids for mistakes I've made? How many of you have a problem with that? You have permission to disagree with the Bible right now. How many of you have a problem with that? Yeah. Can you imagine? What kind of God are we dealing with here? I made a mistake when I'm 25. And then 15 years later, God decides, you know, I never really punished Cohen for Josh's sin. It's about time to do that. And I was in a conversation with somebody a couple weeks ago, and she said some things had happened with her kid, and her kid had made some decisions, and life was difficult. And the lady said, she's being punished for what I've done. I made some mistakes when I was younger, and now she's being punished for the mistakes I made. And guess what passage she quoted? Exodus 20. It's right there in the Bible. God's going to punish the kids for the parents' sins. That's a troublesome passage. What kind of God are we dealing with who wants to punish people to the third? I mean, can you imagine your great-grandchildren being punished for something you did? I mean, that makes moving out of that guilt and shame level all the worse, doesn't it? How do you move on out of guilt and shame for your past and your mistakes when you know God is like, you know what, when you're a great-grandkid, they're going to get it. That just seems troublesome. But that's not the Bible's last word on this. You remember when we talked about Abraham and how Abraham was going to sacrifice his son Isaac to God? And then God essentially says, that's how Abraham believed, that's what Abraham believed God was like, and so that's what he's going to do. And then God says to Abraham, don't sacrifice your son. Right, we assume that people in the Bible have God all figured out and they know everything. And what we're finding, what I'm finding at least, and it's very liberating, is that they don't. Abraham, in that moment, learned something about God. God doesn't want your kids. Right? That's a big deal. I think what we're about to see is another moment where people learn something about God. Notice Ezekiel chapter 18. This is the prophet. The Lord's word came to me. What do you mean by this proverb of yours about the land of Israel? When parents eat unripe grapes, the children's teeth suffer. Another way that's said is when the parents eat sour grapes, the children's teeth are set on edge. What is that passage saying right there? What does that quote say? It says that what the parents do, the kids suffer for. Now, is it possible that I can make decisions that would cause my family to suffer? Absolutely. Our decisions affect everybody around us. But that is a really different statement than saying, when I make a mistake, God holds them accountable. Right? Sin, mistakes, those sorts of things breed consequences, and it affects everybody. But that's really different than saying, God's out to punish my great-grandkids because of something I did when I was 30. Right? What do you mean by this proverb? As surely as I live, says the Lord God, no longer will you use this proverb in Israel. All lives are mine. The life of the parent and the life of the child belong to me. Only the one who sins will die. People are declared innocent when they act justly and responsibly. God quotes the Bible to Ezekiel. Ezekiel, what do you all mean by this? Because that's not what I'm like at all. In the time of Moses, it's a big leap forward to say, God only punishes the kids and grandkids. He doesn't get the next generation, but God's good to everybody in the family that does right. It's a big leap forward. But here in Ezekiel comes back and he says, you know what God's actually like? God doesn't hold kids accountable for what their parents have done. Everybody's accountable for their own mistakes and sin. Do you see what's happening there? In this passage in Exodus, Ezekiel is calling it out and saying, no, that's not what God is like. God does not punish their kids and grandkids and great-grandkids based on what mom and dad have done. Mom and dad are responsible for mom and dad's sin. And so when that lady's quoting Exodus 20 to me, and she's saying, this is just how it is. I'm being punished. She's being punished. Do you know what the joy was for me is to be able to say, actually, have you read Ezekiel 18? Because what we find in Ezekiel 18 is God saying that's not how it works anymore. And that viewpoint is actually destructive. And that you and I are held responsible for what we've done. And our kids will be held responsible for what they've done. And their kids will be held responsible. And God isn't following us around waiting to punish our kids and grandkids because of mistakes we made when we were 20, 30, 40, 50, however old you were when you made mistakes. And then the Ten Commandments continue. Do not use the Lord your God's name as if it were of no significance. Some older translations read, in vain. I love this. Don't use it as if it were of no significance. The Lord won't forgive anyone who uses his name that way. What does it mean to use the Lord's name in vain? I'm not going to give you examples of that really at this point because I don't think that would be helpful. I think we all know what we generally assume is meant by that. It's using God's name often in connection with other words and those sorts of things. I think anytime we use God's name carelessly, that counts. But I really think what this passage is getting at, and studying it, it's led me to believe that this is really talking about how we speak of God and the way we use God to get what we want. For example, when somebody doubts you're telling the truth, and you say, "I hold my hand to God." What are you doing in that moment? Or you say, I swear to God, I'm telling you the truth. What are you doing in that moment? You are invoking God to somehow make yourself more credible, right? I mean, that's what you're doing. You're invoking God to make yourself more credible. Jesus actually addresses this in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, don't make these kind of oaths. Let your yes be yes. Let your no be no. Don't use God to make people take you seriously. This is ultimately what we're being asked to do. Don't use God as a way to make people take you seriously. There's a phrase I never use. And it's been a conscious thing for probably about the last 7-8 years. I do not use this phrase. And if you use this phrase a lot, this is not me judging you or condemning you. You have to do what your conscience allows you to do. I just have made a decision consciously not to use this phrase. Here's the phrase. God told me. I've grown up my whole life hearing people say, well, God told me. God told me. God told me. Why do I not use that phrase? Is it because I believe that God doesn't speak to people? Absolutely not. I believe God speaks to us. There are many, many times deep in my gut, I feel like I'm being led by the Spirit of God to move, to believe, to act in a certain way. I really do believe that. I believe God does those things. The problem I have with saying God told me is that creates a situation then where when I say God told me we need to do this, if you argue with me, who are you arguing with? You're arguing with God, not me, because God told me. And you know what? There have been times I really believed God was leading me somewhere, and I got there, and guess what? God had nothing to do with it. That was all me. It wasn't that God was leading me. It's that my wishful thinking was leading me, and I was beginning to see things and interpret them as God leading me that way. Now, there are times that I've really felt, and I'll give you an example of this. Last year, when we made the decision as a church to open up our leadership to women, I really believed that that's what God was leading us toward. I really believed that that was the best way to read those passages. I believed that the Spirit of God was pulling us in that direction. With everything in me, I believed that. And I was so tempted to get up and say to you, God told me that this is what we need to do. But if God told me that, then you're not free to disagree. And you're not free to argue. And you're not free to say, well, what if God tells me something else, right? So instead, we decided as a group of leaders, we're going to leave this up to the church. And we're going to explain our position and why we feel led this way. But at no point am I ever going to say to you guys to try to, in a heavy-handed way, push something forward, God told me this. Not because I don't believe God doesn't or can't tell us things, but because I believe that in many ways is a misuse of God's name. Because that is invoking God to get what I want. And sometimes that subverts the process of the Spirit in other people's lives. If this is really where God is leading, hopefully we'll all get on board with it. Right? If this is really where, maybe that's not the case all the time, but if this is really what God is doing, hopefully we're all going to, more of us is going to sense it than just me. And so I don't like to talk about God telling me things, even though I deeply feel connected to the Spirit and led by the Spirit in so many different times in my journey. I think another thing that this commandment means is that when we talk a lot about God and we don't, our lives don't back it up. Have you ever been in traffic behind somebody with a Christian fish on their car or Christian, and not just a Christian fish, but the one that's eating the Darwin fish, like the aggressive Christian fish that's trying to eat all the other fish? You ever been, or they have that like Jesus saves bumper sticker or something like that. And then they cut you off and run you into a ditch and just keep going. Now, I would qualify that as taking God's name in vain, right? Because we've talked about God in a very specific way here. And then you just do something that's very ungodly. I had a friend who was telling me after the service that years and years and years ago, it was before he was a part of a church, before he was a Christian, he said, he was driving on a motorcycle and this big, massive truck came over and cut him off and hit him and knocked him over. He looked up as he was skidding down the road on his bike. He looked up and he saw this truck. The woman and the man both look at him, and then they just speed away. And as they're speeding away, he said, had a bumper sticker that said, "Christians aren't perfect, just forgiven." And he said, not on that day they weren't. When we talk about God in certain ways, and then our lives, and again, this is not about being perfect. I screw up as probably more than most of you, but there's this sense of like, when we talk about God in such definite ways, like this is what God is like, and this is what God is, and we stand so firmly on it, and then we turn around and our lives do not support that. I mean, that's the height of hypocrisy. It's one thing to say about some things I don't know and I'm trying to figure it out. It's another thing to say I do know, I'm just refusing to live it. And so I think that when we do those sorts of things, when our lives don't match our verbiage, then I think that that's when we're taking God's name in vain. We're choosing. And I think when we do that all the time, we take God's name in vain in this way, I think it makes people run for the hills, because why would they want to be a part of something like that? Next. Remember the Sabbath day and treat it as holy. 6 days you may work and do all your tasks, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. Do not do any work on it, not you, your sons or daughters, your male or female servants, your animals, or the immigrant who's living with you. So this is a command. The word Sabbath means cease, and this is a divine command to rest. And not just for the homeowners, it's everybody in their house, their animals, everything gets a break. And it's grounded in Exodus because the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and everything in it in 6 days, but he rested on the seventh. That's why the Lord blessed the Sabbath and made it holy. Ten commandments occur in three places in the Bible. It occurs in Exodus 20. It occurs again in Exodus 34, but there are actually 11 or 12 in Exodus 34. And then in Deuteronomy 5. In Deuteronomy 5, the reason given for the Sabbath is because God rescued the people from Egypt. And because you're no longer a slave, you've been set free. So take a day off to remind yourself that God set you free. This command is grounded in, you need to take a day off a week because God did. Because God made the world. And I think the implicit in here is, God made the world, you didn't. God sustains the world, you don't. How many of you have ever felt like, if I took a day off, everything in the world would fall apart, the world would spin out of its orbit, and we would all die a slow and painful death? Anybody feel that way? Like, I can't take a day off, because if I take a break, the space-time continuum will rip apart at its seams. We really feel like we're more important than we are, guys. You know what's going to happen if you take a day off? Nothing, other than you're going to rest. And you're going to get behind on some things, and that's what, you know, Monday's for, or Sunday, or whatever. But there's this divine commanded day of rest to recharge, re-energize, and be renewed and refueled. And I'm not a legalist. I don't care when you take it, but we all need a break. We live such out-of-balance lives. We're so busy. We all need a divinely mandated break to just recharge and re-energize. How many of you have ever worked so hard and been so stressed and so busy that you've actually gotten yourself sick? Yeah. Yeah, and if we just listen, take a break, relax, breathe, do nothing. It's sacred. Honor your father and your mother so that your life will be long on the fertile land the Lord God is giving you. So a command about honoring our parents. Do not kill. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not testify falsely against your neighbor. Don't lie. Do not desire your neighbor's house. Do not desire and try to take your neighbor's wife, male or female servant, ox, donkey, or anything else that belongs to your neighbor. Now, we don't do this often, but I really want an honest confession here from you guys. How many of you have ever, the word here desire is good, but how many of you ever coveted your neighbor's donkey? Can we just, like, I just really want to know. Okay, we have one donkey. How many of you ever coveted your neighbor's ox? Anybody? How many of you ever coveted your neighbor's spouse? Do not raise your hands at this point. That could lead to all sorts of issues. This word desire I love here, by the way. It gets to the heart of what coveting is. And if you remember, we started in Genesis. And what was the big problem in Genesis? Wrongly directed desire. Adam and Eve desired to play God. Cain desired power over Abel. Jacob desired Esau's blessing. This misappropriated desire has been rampant through the biblical story. And it's interesting that the commandments end with this. Don't let inappropriately directed desire ruin your life. The rabbis actually say that the 10th command can be seen, instead of a command, it can be seen as a promise. That when you have honored God, when you have lived your life in harmony with God, harmony with people, when you're being honest, when you're not telling lies, when you're not killing other people, when you're living these commands out, you won't want anybody else's life. Because the life that you're building with God and the people around you and what you have is enough. Can you imagine what would happen to the advertising agencies like who are intent on telling us that unless you have the iPhone, the newest iPhone, your life is insignificant? Can you imagine if we didn't listen all the time? Can you imagine if we didn't base our worth and value on how much money we made? What would it be like if you didn't base your worth and value on how big your house was? What if you didn't base your worth and value on how many donkeys you have compared to your neighbors, which I know gets all of us all the time? I mean, we're continually buying into this myth that we need more. And I do all the time. I mean, I'll tell you, when the latest iPhone came out, I was really bummed that it wasn't time for an upgrade. And somehow felt less of a human being because I wasn't getting the new upgrade whenever all my friends were. You know what I mean? Like, and how many times do we do that? And then we like leverage everything we own and go into debt to get the thing that catches us up. And then you find out 2 months later, oh, but they're releasing the 7. Right? Or you get that car that you've been wanting for so long and you get it and you drive it off the lot. And then on the way home, you hear a commercial on the radio that says, and now they make it with Wi-Fi. And you want to take it back so bad, but you've already lost like $100,000 and it's like negative because you drove it off the lot. I mean, the things we allow to capture us. And this says, don't get into this desire game where you want everybody else's stuff. It ultimately leads to pain and loss. And your life is a gift. Your life is a gift. What if you were to wake up tomorrow and be able to say, what I have, who I have with me, this life I've been given is enough. And if we can ever get a bigger house, that's great. If we can ever get a new car, that's great. Can I tell you the thing I covet more than anything else? And I'm just going to admit this publicly. I covet, what I'm really jealous of is when people have dogs that are obedient. And I'm not making this up. Like, for me, this is a big deal because we have never owned a dog that's obedient. And I'm really starting to think it comes back on the owners. Not so much the animals, but I've never been able to have a dog that's obedient. I mean, I have friends who can look at their dog and the dog just sits. And my dog, like, doesn't even know what that means. You know what I mean? Like, and I just look at my friends who walk their dogs and the dog is just walking beside them very obediently. I mean, Austin Neighbors is like the dog whisperer. He can make this thing happen. But you know what happens when I take my dog on a walk? She will get mad at me and refuse to move, and then I'll try to jerk her along, and then she ends up throwing up. That's what happens on our dog walks. And so I'm not even allowed to take her out anymore. Carla has to do it, because if I take her on a walk, somebody's going to throw up, me or her, something bad's going to happen. I'm really jealous of that. And I have friends, we went trick-or-treating at Don Davis's house the other night, and Don Davis has an awesome dog. And I left there thinking, my stupid dog, Don Davis, has a nice dog that listens and... I mean, we kind of get all knotted up about what other people have, but the reality is what if you and I were to actually look at our lives and realize that we have been given so much and we're really blessed. We really are blessed. We've started trying this new thing at our house, and I don't know how it's going to work, but whenever somebody, and we've really been doing it with me more than anything, but really I need to do it too, but if you say something negative, then you immediately have to follow it up with 3 things you're grateful for. What would that do to our lives if the one negative thing we said, we immediately had to follow up with, yeah, but I've got this, and I've been given this, and I've been blessed with this. That's a game changer in some ways. Don't want what other people have. Don't want what's not yours. Be grateful and content with what you've been given. So a couple things about the Ten Commandments, and we'll go. First, I believe the Exodus and the Ten Commandments are all about God's grace. We often, there's a misreading of the Hebrew Bible, of the Old Testament, and it comes, it's born out of anti-Semitism, and it's very old within Christianity because Christians very quickly turned to, which anti-Semitism means essentially hating Jews. And Christians got on that bandwagon pretty quickly. And there's this reading of the Old Testament that says the Old Testament is all about legalism, and it's all about earning God's approval, it's all about earning your salvation, it's all about earning. Well, nobody told that to the people who wrote the Old Testament. Because the Exodus story, for example, before they're ever given a command, before they ever get the thou shalts and thou shalt nots, what happens to them? God sends Moses to set them free. I'd put it like this. Deliverance precedes everything else. Before there's Sinai, before there's a commandment, before it talks about how to cut your beard or what food you can eat, before any of those moments happen, God, in an act of sheer grace and love, liberates the people from slavery. Before Abraham had ever been circumcised, before he'd circumcised his kids, what does God do? God meets Abraham and invites him into a relationship prior to anything else. So we have this, can Judaism be turned into a legalistic faith? Yes. But brothers and sisters, can Christianity be turned into a legalistic faith? Yes. Many of us grew up in it. And to begin with, the Old Testament, the Exodus, which is the foundational story, it's about God delivering a people who were enslaved and they couldn't help themselves. This is what the story is about. And then after this liberation, does God invite them into a relationship that has responsibilities? Yes, but that's part of a relationship. Michael Duggan says, the commandments do not produce salvation. They preserve redemption, the redemption God has provided by his gracious initiative. The commandments describe how the Israelites can preserve their freedom and God gave them by bringing them through the sea to Sinai. Brian McLaren, hold on, we'll get to that in a second. So, what are the commandments about? They're about, if you want to stay free, you were slaves in Egypt and you didn't have a say. If you want to stay free people, not just physically free, but if you want to be free at the soul level, spiritually, deeply free, then here's how you live. Can you imagine much easier it is? How many of you ever told a lie and you had to tell like 100 more lies to cover up the one lie? Isn't that exhausting? And you have to keep track of it too, because you have to know what lie you told to whom. Because if you tell the wrong lie to the wrong person, then you're in big trouble. The whole plan is busted. Isn't it much easier and freer to just be honest? Isn't it much free? You know, I think honesty can have tact with it. It can be given in compassion. This is the longest my hair's been in years. And I'm just telling you, I'm growing it out because I don't know how much longer I've got. So I'm really intent on enjoying this, whatever is going to happen. I'm getting a little thin back, you know, it's receding a little back there, so I'm swooping it down. Whatever I got to do, I'm just going to make sure I enjoy it while I have it. Somebody told me the other day, your hair, you need to cut that. Now, not tactful. Tactful. I notice you have a luscious mop on your head. Perhaps you should consider eliminating some of that. Tactful, right? There are nice ways, compassionate ways to say things to people. I think when somebody walks in, you go, oh, did you wear that? Not appropriate. You know, oh, I like your other dress. You know, that maybe that's appropriate. I don't know. But there's this, it's better to be honest. Can you imagine a life? Is it better to kill people or not kill people? Your reluctance on that is unnerving at best. Is it better to cheat on your spouse or not cheat on your spouse? Again, your reluctance on that is slightly unnerving. We often read the Ten Commandments like this. Here's how you go to heaven. Growing up, that's how they were used on us. They were used, have you broken any of these? Then you can't go to heaven. Here's the problem with reading it like that. And that may be, you know, fine. But when these commands were written down, the Jewish people had no concept of heaven. That came later. They hadn't learned that whole afterlife thing yet. So they were very much not thinking about, we have to do this to go to heaven. They were much thinking about, this is what it means to be in relationship with God. So instead of starting the Ten Commandments with, if you want to go to heaven, do these things, read them like this. This is what liberation and freedom look like. If you want to remain free, not just from Egyptian bondage, but the bondage of sin and desire, then live this way. If you want to be free from the problems that are plaguing humanity, which is really all boiled down to, I want what other people have. I want to be God. I want to be, you know, the guy who's driving that car. Or I want to be the girl married to that guy. Or I want to be the people living in that house. If you want to be free from that, then here's the way to be free. Keep God first. Don't make images of God that can't live up. Right? Honor the Sabbath. Stop killing one another. Tell each other the truth. Be faithful to your spouse. I mean, these commands are a recipe for freedom. Brian McLaren says, the Exodus got people out of slavery. The commandments are intended to get the slavery out of the people. Do you see the difference? We often talk about salvation as this instantaneous moment where God takes his magic wand and pops us with it, and now everything's perfect. But that's not the case. When the Hebrews leave slavery, they still have a long way to go. And you and I, we're on a journey. And saved in the Bible, the word saved is always used in the progressive sense. It's always incomplete. Salvation is incomplete until you and I are no longer breathing this breath. And so for us, the question maybe, you know, the journey of salvation for us then is, it's not about God getting us, you know, forgiven. We're already forgiven. The journey of salvation is about us learning and growing into what does a really forgiven person live like and look like? What does it look like to be forgiven? And it's not an issue of earning, because grace doesn't make us spectators. It makes us possible for us to be active participants. Dallas Willard put it like this: grace is not opposed to effort. It is opposed to earning. Earning is an attitude. Effort is an action. The Ten Commandments were never about earning. Do this, 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 and earn. The Ten Commandments were about, I've set you free. And now if you want to remain free, it's going to require your participation. If you want to become the person you were born to be, it's going to require your participation. I've really found in my life that prayers for patience and prayers to be more generous and prayers to be more compassionate ultimately just lead to opportunities to do those things. Right? When I ask God, make me more patient, often the situation comes up, I need to be really patient. And we grow in patience and compassion and love by being in moments where we choose to exercise those muscles opposed to other ones. So the Ten Commandments aren't saying, go earn your way into God's grace. It's saying, you've already got God's grace. Go learn what it looks like to be a part of it. And finally this, and we'll go. The commands call us to be in the present. I have a friend who, I think he totally made these numbers up, but they make sense to me. We live 60% of our lives in the past. We live 30% of our lives in the future. We live 10% of our lives in the present. That math adds up to 100, right? Yes, good. So proud. We live 60 in the past, 30 in the future, 10 in the present. And I think that's a valid point. We live the biggest chunk of our time, at least I have, is regretting things I've done in the past. And can I just tell you, if Doc Brown showed up today with a DeLorean, I would totally go back and do some things different. Wouldn't you? Aren't there things, I mean, people who say there's nothing in the past they would change, I'm just wondering, like, are you paying attention? Of course there was things we'd like to change, but we can't do that. And I would love to know what the future is going to be like. How many of you worry about the future? Like, am I going to be able to retire? When am I going to be able to retire? If you've got kids, you're probably, a bulk of your concern is spent on what kind of world are they going to inherit from us? Is this going to be a place worth living in? Is this going to be a place that we would want them to grow up in? We live a lot of time in the future. Jesus talked about the future. Jesus said, you can't even make one hair brown or gray. Why do you worry about the future that's out of your control? Obviously, Jesus didn't know about Just for Men or herbal essences at that point. But you get his point. There are so many things out of our control. Why do we spend our time, energy, and worry ourselves into an ulcer about something we ultimately can't control? We get to the future at the exact same clip, a second at a time together. The commands call us to be present. They don't deal with the past. They don't deal with the future. They deal with now. This is the gift of the commandments. They allow us to live in the present, here and now. What I've done in the past is past mending. What I will do in the future is a worry not worth the candle. For there's no way I can know what will happen next. But in this moment, I'm in control. This is the moment of choice, the moment when I decide whether I will plunge in the knife or not, take the treasure or not, begin to spin the liar's web or not. This is the moment when the past can be transformed and the future lit with radiance. You can't change the past, but when you walk with God in his grace and you're growing in God's grace, you begin to see the past differently. And what used to seem like a catastrophic failure becomes a stepping stone in the wilderness, a bad thing that God can transform into making you the person you were born to be. And the future we spend all of our time worrying about is directly impacted by the decisions we make today. Your tomorrow, my tomorrow, will be shaped by the choices we make today. So we should think about today. And let's, as we get ready to leave, let's let these commands lead us into today. Will we honor God with our lives today? Will we be singularly focused on God today? Not all these other things that distract us. Will we live and speak in ways that takes God's holiness seriously today? Will we pay attention to and take care of our souls through intentional times of rest and play? George was here earlier this year, I think, and he talked about play and the idea of rest and play being a very biblical thing, enjoying some time. Will we live with gratitude, honor, and respect? Will we refuse violence and the anger and bitterness that make it possible? Nobody goes from zero to homicide. It begins when somebody's refusing to deal with what's really going on under the surface. Anger, bitterness, rage. Will we refuse the infidelity and the lust that makes this possible? Nobody goes from zero to adultery that quickly. There's a current under the surface of lust that is out of control. Will we refuse to take what isn't ours? Will we speak honestly? Will we refuse to allow desire and rivalry to have the last word over our lives? These are the choices. You know, we may not get to decide what hair color we have. We may not get to decide how tall we are. We may not get to decide where we're born into the family we're born. But you and I get to decide what we do today. We get to decide who we're going to become because you and I are making the choices today that will influence who we become tomorrow. So if you really want to take care of the future, the best way to take care of the future is to be present today, be focused on today, to live in the flow of God's grace today. Does that make sense? And when we do this, God essentially says, and when you allow this to happen in your life, you become a precious, chosen, set-apart people, and your purpose then becomes to tell the rest of the world why this grace is so captivating, why this grace is so transforming, why you are how you are. Let's pray. God, grateful for this day and for this breath. Grateful for these commands, which if we ignore them, we do to our own peril because they invite us not to take your grace seriously. These commands are not rules that we're called to follow so we can have grace. They're a rhythm we're called to live in because of your grace so that we can become the free, alive people we are meant to be. So today, as we leave, go with us. May your Spirit give us eyes to see, ears to hear all the opportunities we have today to be faithful and true today, to honor you, and show you to the world today. We ask all these things in Jesus' name. Everybody said, amen. Let's stand together. Just so you know, a couple things. There's going to be a chamber choir concert today at 2 here. So if you're interested in listening to the chamber choir sing, come back out here at 2 o'clock. And then we're also doing elder nominations and elder selection team selection. So if you would like to nominate somebody for the elder selection team, the elder selection team essentially is made up of 3 congregation members, an elder, and a staff person, and they will be the people interviewing the nominees for our elder position. So if you are interested in nominating someone, get their permission, and they need to be a covenant member, which means they've been through the membership class and signed the covenant, and you can nominate them here. And there's also a nomination for elder. We're an elder-led church. You can find out about that on these sheets, and you can nominate the man or woman who you would like to see, you feel like they could serve as an elder. Get their permission first. We don't like to surprise people with those phone calls when they're like, I didn't say that. So get their permission. We have Scott Cox and Glenn Gilstrap rolling off. Elders who are rolling off can be renominated as well. So if you talk to those guys. But whatever, if you want to nominate somebody, here's the form. You can drop it in the offering bowls. You can give it to me, give it to Tommy, give it to one of our elders, and we'll make sure it gets where it's going. Okay? All right. May you walk in the freedom that you've been given. And may you and I become the people that we're born to be. Grace and peace be with you.